Good evening, you all. I'm K2, Romeo, India Whiskey. At this time, as we've done for 34 years, let me think now, 1982. 35 years. 35 years and a couple of months, we run the technical net. For approximately 4 hours, if there's enough enthusiasm to go that long. The main purpose of the technical net, as you've heard me say so often, is education. Curious radio amateurs get together at this time, on this frequency, to teach each other what they've learned and what they'd like to know about wireless equipment, transmitters, receivers, antennas, propagation, the 27 different kinds of ham radio. A person signs into the technical net by giving this group your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need that sign in to say you're listening. After 35 years, we've got reasonable reason to believe that somebody is listening. That happens automatically. This particular technical net is also connected by way of IRLP and Echolink, so people from outer states, sometimes outer countries, listen and report. And we'd like to hear from them also. The philosophy of the technical net is that there is no such thing as a dumb question. A so-called dumb question represents the biggest difference between what the person knows and what he would like to know. Therefore, it's the question most deserving of an answer. So if you think you've got a dumb question and you're too bashful to ask it, don't worry. Also, we've got a couple of crazy rules. Like 2 weeks ago, Bob W82AXZ signed in, and we didn't get a chance to get to him because we got hung up on some other subject for a long period of time. So he was number one on the runway the next week, which was last week. And by that same token, last week, Joe W82RYY signed in. We didn't get to him. And Matt N2RVP signed in. We didn't get to him in time. So those guys, if they sign in tonight, they will be number one on the runway, so to speak. Let me drop. Try to remember each time you're about to transmit to wait for the four beeps so that the machine doesn't time out. So those are most of the rules and regulations. We will be having tonight Roy AC2GS with his physics science talk section. We'll be giving that a little bit more time tonight, as well as Paul WAC, WS2N with his space report. So that's the group, K2RIW as an interlocutor, Roy AC2GS with science and physics, and Paul WS2N with the space report. You're allowed to express your opinions. The technical net as it presently stands is a compendium of opinions that we've heard over the years of what people want to hear, what they like, what they dislike, so they express their opinions, and if there's enough people with that opinion, we listen to it. No guarantee that everything you hear is going to be 100% accurate. Let me drop. But to a certain degree, what you do hear, you could say, is peer-reviewed or about to be peer-reviewed material. Every single TechNet for the last 10 or 11 years is recorded and on a website by Mike number one, KC2NJI, and you can find that one at Limark TechNet, amateurradio.tv, amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that website, choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back everything that took place on the TechNet for that particular weekend. Mike number two also has an accompanying website, limarktechnet.com, which has additional pictures and articles and graphs and whatever that support the TechNet. So by way of the recordings, when we do make an error, somebody listens to that recording, reports it to us, and on the next week we correct the error. So it's not 100% accuracy, but there is a kind of slightly delayed peer review. Okay, at this time I'm going to take the check-ins for those who do have a question or a comment. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, the word yes, meaning you got a question or a comment, and each one of you are going to wait for the four beeps. K2RIW listening.
K2GJE Yes.
W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
KC-1-S-A-M, Sam, yes.
So far we have Ed, Joe, and Sam. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now and name. K2RIW listening.
This is KC-2, Queen, Yankee, Whiskey. Name here is Joe, and yes.
We got you, Joe. Anyone else?
KC-2, S-H-O, John, in Los Alamos. If there's time for one, I could throw around a question.
Very fine, John. And I seem to remember the last time we talked to you, you have a fair amount of experience to nuclear exposure. I guess you could tell us what millisieverts, microsieverts, and sieverts represent as far as maximum lethal dose, MLD 50-30 type things. I believe you could answer questions along those lines. Is that roughly true, John? Over to you, John.
Well, I don't have the values for our work environment here memorized, but I could probably find that relatively quickly, but I would not say I'm an expert on this.
Maybe nobody's really an expert, but at least you're aware it's happening, and therefore your answer would be more valuable to us than many others. Okay, Joe was in last week, and he didn't get a chance to go, so we're going to put him number one. So go ahead with your question, Joe. W-H-R-Y-Y, a carryover from last week, K2-R-I-W in TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. I have a question and a comment. The question is very simple. Did you receive my email with the subject related to ground loop problems? That requires a yes or a no.
Okay, I received a beautiful memo from Steve on that subject, which showed some very nice Fluke equipment that does those measurements. Did your email, or maybe yours also referred to the beautiful website on Wikipedia? Wikipedia has a very nice report on ground loops. And as I said, Fluke has instrumentation that can measure it. And the particular email you sent to me, was that more than a week ago? Over to you, Joe.
Yes, I'm gonna remember to do this every time. I'm going to put my call letters in the subject line as the first thing you see. That way, when you look at the subject line, you'll recognize who it's coming from. It was sent about 2 weeks ago. It was a PDF, I believe, of an article. Okay, so you'll have to look and see if you actually received it. If you did, you did. If you didn't, I can always resend it again if you can confirm that you did receive it. But I have a comment on the subject you talked about last week, and actually the week before that, as far as measurements. I was able to duplicate that measurement and that effect with my Fluke 77 at home, and if you'd like to find out what I did to do that, I'll be glad to tell you.
Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, very good. Interesting thing I found out about the Fluke, when you're trying to measure it changes, the tip voltage can vary from only about 40 to 50 millivolts up to about 2 volts as you change ranges manually in the ohm scale. And when you put on auto, it just simply turns on to ohms. It goes to the highest scale, and then it may change voltages depending on the resistance it seems to encounter. Okay, what I did is I took, being as a bit of a scientist to me, just like you, I had to find out if I could, what the thing would read, because I tried reading between the ground and the neutral wire of some outlets of my house, and I got the same kind of effect, right? It seems that what happens is if you're reading AC millivolts, if there are AC millivolts or a signal AC voltage on or across across the conductor you're trying to measure, as you're measuring resistance, it will throw the meter off. And they did this by taking a variac and putting the thing at 0 volts across a 0.7 ohm resistor I use for calibrating power supplies as a load. So with the variac completely off, turned up to zero, I measured 0.7 ohms across the resistor with the Fluke on the ohm scale. The next thing I did was introduce about 100 millivolts of ripple across that resistor, and then I tried measuring the resistance again. Now I saw the resistance actually go a little higher, but changed. It was not in a steady type of state. And in a reversal lease, the reading went a little lower in reading. So the next thing I did was go up to about 300 millivolts. At this point, I saw the ohms definitely changing from what I knew the resistance should be to something of almost twice the resistance value. And when I reversed the lease, sure enough, it gave me a negative ohms reading on the Fluke 77. So apparently, the Fluke can't do it correctly if it sees something else along with the resistance you try to measure, some sort of AC component across the device that you try to measure with low ohms, like in the case of measuring grounds, it will throw the meter off. You got to be very careful about that by probably checking AC millivolts a reading first before you try to confirm your ohms reading. Back to you.
The so-called, you kept referring to the Fluke. The Fluke did this, the Fluke did that. I am guessing you're talking about a particular model of a Fluke digital voltmeter that you own. But whether it be a digital voltmeter, or whether it be a volt-ohm milliammeter, a Simpson or a triplet, in either case, there is a battery inside. In the case of a Simpson and a triplet, you've got a D cell, or in some cases two D cells, I think, which represent a source of current that's used in the ohm meter mode. When you're trying to measure the number of ohms of a resistor, which is a thoroughly passive component, you could put any meter you want, voltmeter, ammeter, wattmeter, across a passive resistor, and you'll read nothing. You can only sense the fact that it's got resistance when you put a known amount of current through it, and you measure how many volts drop you get with that known amount of current. And by Ohm's law, the machine calculates ohms for you. So the whatever ohm meter you're using, whether it be a digital voltmeter or a volt-ohm milliammeter, it's applying a known amount of DC current to the resistor under test, and it expects to measure some number of millivolts or volts, and then it then calculates that into ohms. Let me drop. If there's any other source of current or voltage simultaneously going into that resistor under measurement, then there is no way that your ohm meter measuring device can separate the extraneous current from the intended current, from the current you're trying to apply. Therefore, the readings become suspect. DC is a little bit more destructive than AC. In the case of AC current, still it's going to give you a phony reading because the ohm meter is running in the DC voltage measuring mode when it's measuring ohms, and AC voltage superimposed on that. If there's any non-linearity in that AC voltage, or if it's large enough in magnitude that it's starting to become rectified during the voltmeter, DC voltmeter measurement, then of course the reading's going to change. So you have to be sure that by some means there is no extraneous source of current going into your resistor under measurement when you're trying to measure its ohms. And there's almost no way around that I know of, other than measuring AC ohms with some very selective, frequency-selective voltmeter. If you had some kind of a voltmeter that applies, let me pick a number, 77.7 hertz of AC current across a resistor under measurement, and if the ohm meter scale is measuring voltage in a tuned voltage manner, in which it responds, in my example, to 77 hertz and nothing else to the nearest 1 hertz, then you could still measure the number of ohms in the presence of extraneous currents. Very few instruments operate that way. So when you kept referring to the Fluke, I presume it was a particular model of digital Fluke digital voltmeter that you own. Is that true, Joe? To be KQLYY, KQLYW.
Repeater, timeout.
Yes, I believe I said it was a Fluke 77. Handheld digital VLM. And I didn't hear that mention when the original operator was making the measurements between grounds on cabinets. All I heard mentioned was they were making measurements in the ohms mode, and the reading was going up and down and up and down. I didn't hear anybody mention that they looked for another voltage at the same time during that measurement, like on another scale. Like, like this is why I brought the subject up. Just like you said, if it's got, there's two signals at once, it can't separate the two signals, then it's going to give you a crazy reading. And I, like I said, I was able to basically duplicate what was said, what was measured with the meter and the ohm scale, of the thing going higher in resistance, changing, and also by reversing the leads and having the leads out, the indicator gave you a negative lead, a negative indication on the VLM. Fluke 77 is what I use.
It turns out that Andy did tell us he made a voltage measurement. Fucked up. He was actually measuring the voltage drop between the bulkhead that brought in the 7/8 inch Heliax cable to the cabinet, between that bulkhead and cabinet. And sometimes the pair of 632 screws, stainless steel screws, that screwed down that bulkhead, he was putting his digital voltmeter across those two screws and measuring a voltage drop. So he had lots of indication that an extraneous current was flowing into that cabinet, because he was using that in the voltmeter scale of his particular digital voltmeter. So, you wanted to make a comment about ohmmeter measurement, and you had another real question. Go ahead with your question, Joe.
No, the question was simply, did you receive my email? That was my question, because I never can answer back to you, so I never know if it goes one way and never, you know, it doesn't get there. And I said, I have a question and a comment. I asked the question, and I relayed my comment to you about the measurements I made with my Fluke 77. That's it for this week.
Very fine, Joe. And the particular ground loop current article that you mailed to me, what was the source of that particular article, Joe?
I'd have to check when I get able to get back to a computer and go on the internet. I don't recall exactly where I got the article. I found it under Google by simply putting in ground loop problems. Either ground loop or ground loop problems. I started reading about a bunch of things, and one of them was like a handout by a guy by the name of Bill, who was an engineer working for some particular company. He was talking all about different ground loop effects with audio equipment and the likes, and the whole thing was in a PDF format, so I just copied the PDF, saved it, and then emailed the same PDF file to you. So you're looking for a PDF file.
Very fine, Joe. You've given me lots of hints as to what to look for. Thank you. There are lots of people who have expressed good and not so good opinions on the so-called topic of ground loops. On many pieces of equipment where multiple components within a single chassis have to be grounded, in some cases, what some people have done is to declare a particular screw somewhere in the middle of the cabinet as the grounding point, and all wiring is brought back to that single screw and its grounding lug, as opposed to grounding in each individual tube socket, so to speak. And some of the deleterious effects of ground loops are avoided by that particular wiring. In the case of what Andy's working with, quite possibly he will be using some kind of a DC ground loop isolating device that disconnects the shield DC-wise from the cabinet of the Heliax coming into the cabinet, but AC connects the but capacitive coupling at the RF frequencies in question, the shield will be grounded to the cabinet. And then there will be a separate ground on that particular piece of Heliax for human safety reasons. So, ultimately, the Heliax is going to be grounded, ultimately going back to the exact same ground of the equipment room. Let me drop. Because of a slight difference in the routing of that wiring, the extraneous current flowing through the cabinet can be eliminated, and therefore a simple ohmmeter test between cabinet and room will be able to be confirmed. That's what we're predicting is one of the possible outcomes of this research. Ed is next, K2GJE. Go right ahead with your question, Ed, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2GJE, good evening, Dick. We all know about operating amplifiers as Class A or B, or AB1 or AB2, and Class C, of course. What is this Class E that people are talking about? Over.
Just to go through those very briefly, Ed, Class A is where the current flow is 100% of the time. Class A amplifier is usually the most linear amplifier, but not the most efficient. Class B amplification is where the current flows roughly half the time. So a push-pull Class B audio output stage was something very popular in hi-fi circuits in the old days. Class C, the current flows for a considerably shorter period of time, sometimes 70% of the time. And for FM or Morse code, it's the most efficient mode of transmission. But it's not good for linear amplification, Class C. Then there's a whole lot of other additional letter modes of operation of an amplifier. Class Delta, Class Echo, Class Foxtrot, Class Golf, and so on. Those other modes of current, a quasi-digital mode. In other words, I could be turning on and off the amplifier final stage with a square wave at, let me pick a number, 100 kilohertz. That's one of the modes of operation. With 100 kilohertz, I'm turning on and off with a square wave the output stage of my amplifier. But then by changing the on-off ratio, that's called pulse duration modulation, I can be running that final stage at a very high percentage of efficiency and still linearly amplify my signal of interest by doing the pulse width modulation. I think that's called Class D that I'm describing right now. And then, of course, it's followed by a sharp bandpass filter, a low-pass filter, passing the pulse-width modulated signal's DC component, so to speak, and the 100 KC in my example would be eliminated. So Class D, Class E, Class F, they're all a kind of nonlinear digital that
repeater, timeout.
Each of those higher beyond Class C, D, E, F, G, and whatever, those modes of operation, try to take the last stage of the amplifier and for various periods of time, turn it completely on or completely off. When it's completely on, the tube, so to speak, has a short circuit across it. It's drawing current, but there's no voltage drop, so it's not dissipating any current, any power. And on the other half of its cycle, it's a complete open circuit, although it's got high voltage across it. It's not drawing any current, and again, dissipating no power. So these higher letter designation modes of operation, use your output stage in a quasi-switching mode, hopefully dissipating almost no power, and yet giving you amplification, and in many of those cases, very linear amplification. So the more modern amplifiers do that. There is a carrier restoration technique, for instance, that was used on one of the Oscar satellites by Carl Meinzer. Who used one of those letter-type amplification modes to run at very high efficiency. He had to do that because he had very limited solar input power to that satellite. That's a thumbnail sketch, and if you Google those words, class F, for instance, Class E, I'm pretty sure you'll get a more thorough explanation. On top of that, let me drop it. In QST Magazine in the last couple of years, there was an article on either The Doctor Is In or Technical Topics on this exact subject. So a search of the ARRL archives, if you happen to be an ARRL member, will also give you an article with the nice thing about the QST article is that it's a little bit easier to understand because it's written in ham radio language, if you know what I mean. K2GJE, you're allowed to ask more questions on this one at K2RIW, the TechNet. We use switching transistors, and it's a lot cheaper. So cheap transistors, high efficiency, a little bit more complication, lots of benefits. It's worth seeking. That's what I'm pretty sure that Eric is telling us. Go ahead, Ed.
Thank you, but that leads me to another question. If I do, let's say, pulse width modulation, can that give me 100% peak envelope power over time? Over.
Any mode of operation, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, can give you a peak amplitude modulation once you define what you RF power output is 10 watts. And if my definition of peak envelope power is 10 watts, yes, it can give it to me. So any amplifier can give you your definition of peak envelope power. The way you worded the question suggests that you think that peak envelope power represents the point of 100% efficiency. In the case of Class A, that might be true. But the peak envelope power, any amplifier can give me some amount of peak envelope power once I define it. Over to you, Ed.
In the operation of, let's say, AM or single sideband, the peak envelope power varies with the voice of the person modulating it. But if the peaks are kept always the same and just the width of the peak, is that possible? Over.
Absolutely. If I'm running a pulse width modulated square wave amplifier running at an ultrasonic rate, let's say it's running at 100 kc, and I'm trying to amplify a signal of one kilohertz. This is an audio amplifier. And when I'm running the amplifier at 50% on-off ratio, and this is a push-pull amplifier, so amplifier, tube A is on 50% of the time, tube B is on the other 50% of the time. Therefore, when it's exactly 50%, the average voltage output from that amplifier would be 0 volts. As I go to 45-55 ratio percentage, I'm starting to make a negative voltage. As I go to 55-45, I'm starting to make a positive voltage. So with push-pull, pulse-width modulation, I can make the instantaneous DC voltage output anything from near 0 volts to mere maximum voltage output by modifying nothing but the pulse width. With capacitive coupling to eliminate, let's see now, I'd use DC coupling with a low-pass filter to get my audio output to the loudspeaker, so to speak, to make sure that the 100 kc is not there, but the 1 kc audio is there. So properly implemented, pulse-width modulation can give me everything from 0 volts to maximum volts, and I could hold that voltage for a long period of time if I wanted to. I could actually use a pulse-width modulated push-pull amplifier as a regulated power supply, where the power supply can give me positive, negative, or any voltage in between. By commanding that pulse width, I could make it go to plus 5 volts for the next 5 minutes and minus 5 volts for the next.
Repeater, time out.
Over to you, Ed. KQGJE, KQRIW.
Okay, that's just some thought to do some research. It's a little bit different than having operated HF on Class C over the years. Back to your other clients. Good evening.
Very fine, Ed. Thought you'd like to know that your signal from Bohemia tonight, audio is good, but the RF was a little bit weak. There was a little bit of hiss in the background. So maybe your antenna is not completely aimed at the repeater, or maybe you're not using your normal antenna. You're usually quieter than this. Next person on the list was Sam, KC1, Sugar Alpha Mike. You got it, Sam, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. My question may be a week old, but so last week you had a fellow on your Bob from the New York City subway station and that system. And a question came to mind during the week. You mentioned they were switching over to AC motors in the cars from the DC. And I was just wondering, they're converting DC to AC to run them now. I was just wondering, when they get all new cars and they're all running on AC, are they going to switch the system from DC to AC? You probably don't know, but I'm just wondering if maybe Bob is listening or Andy might be in the background and have an idea about that. Back to you.
Yeah, it's a good question, Sam, and I'm going to make a guess. And my guess is absolutely, positively no. For the last 100 years, approximately, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, as it's now, MTA as it's now called, probably had a whole lot of other names in the earlier days, has roughly 600, 650 volts of DC applied to the third rail, which comes from a tremendous number, probably as many as 300 individual megawatt-type DC power supplies that start off with three-phase, Con Ed, 420 volts or something like that, 1100 volts of AC, which gets rectified to DC, applied to the tracks. And are they going to redesign and redeploy all of that equipment? Absolutely not. What's going on here is that the old-fashioned DC motor, like the starter motor and the generator you used to have in an automobile of, say, 1950, with an armature, commutator, and brushes, all of that is gone. The modern-day so-called brushless DC motor is what the radio control model airplane enthusiasts call it. On the subway system, they call it a brushless AC motor. The DC voltage, let me drop. The DC voltage and thousands of amperes of current picked up by the third rail by an individual subway car goes into a chunk of electronics on that subway car that converts the DC into AC. The AC is applied to the stator windings of that motor. The armature is a permanent magnet, and by changing the frequency of the AC voltage applied to the stator windings, you determine the rate of rotation and the direction of rotation of that motor, the speed, the direction, you could say the amount of torque. You've got complete control of that motor by changing the magnitude and the frequency of the AC voltage generated by the electronics on that subway car being fed to that particular motor. You've now got complete control of that motor. No brushes exist in that motor. No brushes to wear out. The motor is a simple, there may be brushes for the armature, if the armature happens to be a dynamic magnet, but it could be a steady-state magnet, a neodymium magnet, as it is on many automobiles. Let me drop. So therefore, that motor has essentially nothing to wear out. Give it a good set of bearings with a good seal on the bearings so that the grease stays in there. There's no sliding brushes. There's no brushes wearing out. There's no commutator. There's no slip rings. And so now, there's essentially no moving parts in all of that railroad car except that motor and its connection to the wheels. And there's essentially nothing to wear out there except the slip ring that's on the wheel itself that picks up the 650 volt DC from the third rail. So they've designed the cars to work that way to give them complete control. By that infinite control of that motor, you now don't have those great big jolts of start of the subway train like you used to have, when they flip from the series mode to the parallel mode of the windings of the motor, and they flip when they switch from a low dropping resistor to a high dropping resistor and so on. You don't hear all that jolting. You now have a very smooth acceleration of that car when that electronics is properly designed and properly used. So they get all kinds of advantages of life efficiency, longevity, reliability, and comfort for the customers. So they've elected to go that way, and I think they're not going to go any further by changing the stationary part of the system. Only the rolling stock is changing, as I see it. Over to you on that one, Sam. That's my impression of what's going on here. KC1 SAM, K2RIW and TechNet, away for the beep.
And then to Leo.
KD2 HUC with a comment. KC1 SAM picking it up. Bring it back in a second. Yeah, I was looking at just the I guess the moving part of the system, but you're right, the stationary part has got to be massive to power it. Last week was very, very interesting. I grew up in the city using the subways, and it was very interesting, about 2 hours listening to Bob. Anyway, that was my question, and you have answered it. So I'll swing it back to you, and I appreciate K2RIW, this is KC1SAM, and you've got a couple of people in there.
Yeah, we have Rich and Steve in that order. Rich, wait for the beeps, and you got it. N2EO.
Okay, Dick. I wonder how much difference is it all from the Long Island Railroad. You know, I'm out here now in Massapequa Park, so I'm more cognizant of the LIRR. I'll make a comment when the relief furnished the LIRR. Did you know that at that time Governor Rockefeller said he was going to make it the best railroad in the country? He fell short, but he did do a good job.
Okay, the very next person online has worked for lots of years with the Long Island Railroad, Steve, and he's going to answer your question as well as put in his comments. KD2HUC. You sound good tonight, Steve, and sorry we weren't able to hear you last week. You got it, Steve.
I want to answer that previous question about possibly converting the third rail to AC. And you're 100% right. Not a chance in hell that we would ever go AC third rail. And the reason is that even with an AC motor, as you pointed out, you need full control of that motor. And the way that's done is using a variable frequency drive. Now, anybody who knows how a variable frequency drive works, the front end is a rectifier, three-phase. It feeds a DC bus, and then there's an inverter that is used to, you know, for precise control of both frequency and torque current in an induction motor. Let me let it drop. In order to convert to AC, the most efficient means possible within a variable frequency drive, we would have to add another rail in order to provide the three phases. The way we have it now, you have the three-phase feeding a rectifier, which is the front end of a variable frequency drive. We feed the DC to the third rail, and then the inverter is local to the train. And by keeping it that way, we don't have to touch not a stitch of existing infrastructure to get all the benefits of an AC traction motor with the legacy DC system. KD2HUC, back to net.
And I'm guessing the Long Island Railroad is now using a very similar system on their electric trains. I am curious, the actual motors that are driving the wheels of a subway car or of a Long Island Railroad car, is the armature of that motor a permanent magnet, a neodymium magnet? I think it could be. Over to you on that one, Steve, if you happen to know.
For certain, I do not know because I'm not in the equipment department, but my guess is that no, it is not. My guess is that they would use induction motors similar to that used in industry, where the actual currents in the armature are induced from the stator, and therefore you don't need any slip rings or commutator or anything of that nature. And with the programming of today's variable frequency drives, you're actually able to control the torque that is induced in the armature through the waveform that you provide to the stator. It's actually pretty cool the way they do it. There's a lot of details on it. If you look online, you'll see it. I think commercially they're called vector drives, but there's very specific waveforms that they send to the stator in order to control the what currents are induced into the armature. KD2HUC, back to that.
Yeah, in the case of a radio control model aircraft brushless DC motor, it is a permanent magnet armature, which allows it to run a little bit higher efficiency. There is no slip rate. If you use a typical AC motor armature, which is just a squirrel cage-like thing of highly conductive material, and there's a rotating magnetic field around it created by the stator windings and the voltage, the AC voltages, resistance. The three-phase or more phases of the AC voltage fed to those saddle windings, that generates a rotating magnetic field. The armature is forced to follow that rotating magnet field with a certain slip rate. So you get a little bit of inefficiency if it's an armature that's not made of a permanent magnet. And maybe the difference in efficiency is not worth fighting for. On many electric automobiles, it is a permanent magnet armature. On all of the radio control model aircraft engines, it is a permanent magnet armature, usually neodymium magnets. We'll eventually find out about that. And because of the price of those magnets, I can see why they might not have done it that way in the case of these massive motors that are on a railroad car or a subway car. Next person on our list was Joe, KC2QYW. You've got it, Joe. K2YW in the TechNet. Maybe Joe got called away, and we've got some time for John. KC2SHO in Los Alamos. K2RIW, go ahead, John.
I'm sorry, were you trying to call me? This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey.
Yes, we did call you quite twice, Joe, and go right ahead now, Joe. Now that we know you're there, you got it, Joe.
Yeah, roger that. I'll be quick. I was in my car last week. I made a right turn into the gas station over there. And then I decided to leave out of there. So I drove out. And then I made another right turn over there. The light was green. So a police officer pulled me over. And he thought I was going in there so I could go around traffic, to go around that red traffic light over there. But I told him the gas prices was kind of high, and I could go somewhere else, you know, somewhere else to save money. So he was like, "What's that antenna back there?" And all that good stuff. So I told him, you know, I do amateur radio. So my question to you, Dick, is once I said that I do amateur radio, he was like, the police officer was like, yeah, you're free to go. My question to you is, because we're amateur radios, do we get a little like special treatment from from other people with the police force? So that's my question. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if I sense correctly, your question is, do we get special treatment? And the answer is both yes and no. If you were using a cell phone while you were rolling with your automobile, you're subject to getting a citation, because a cell phone while rolling is essentially illegal. And if you were holding a microphone in your hand, talking over ham radio, which is not a cell phone, to many officers, that is not a violation. However, certain counties, certain police departments have now used a different language. Cell phone versus ham radio used to be the language, I believe. And now if you're using an electronic device, which could be a handheld computer, for instance, a Wi-Fi, they don't want you doing that. So a couple of amateur radio operators, at least one ham radio operator we've heard about in the last week, got a citation for using ham radio, but he was given a ticket because it is an electronic device. He fought it in court and won. But still, to be on the safe side, let me drop it. What many amateurs are doing is that when they see a policeman while they're on the road, they put down the microphone. They explain to people, I see a policeman in the future, in the distance. I'm going to put down the microphone for the next 30 seconds until he and I are past each other, just to make sure I don't get into this situation. So for a period of time, ham radio gave us a free pass, as opposed to a cell phone use. But now with this new wording of an electronic device, it looks like we're back in trouble. We got to be careful. Drag your feet in case other people want to add some comments to this one, Joe. KC2QYW, K2LIW in the deck net.
If you're good.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Guy, there's actually two separate laws in the state of New York with the vehicle and traffic law, and actually they keep trying to change it, but they haven't been successful at it. One is a law that says no cell phones, which specifically says the switch telephone network. That's one law. That's the old law. That, at that point in time, we used to be able to argue. And by the way, in the city of New York, they make no exception. The other law that covers distracted driving, and it covers whether you have a microphone in your hand or even a banana, they'll work that law with you. It says any type of electronic device in your hand is considered a no-no, and you will get a ticket, and I think it's 2 points in the state of New York. Not the same in New Jersey, and it's a little bit different in Connecticut. But the reality is that you really need to, if you're going to be seen by a police officer, you need to be using a Bluetooth-type headset or some hands-free device. Anything that you have in your hand in the state of New York is considered distracted driving, and in the city of New York, they make no exception, and I've gotten caught by that myself. K2IWK2J.
You got caught by that, and what happened next, Eric? Wait for the beeps.
Well, in the state of New York, you can almost get away with it, but in the city of New York, the judges are actually administrative people. They're not actually court officers, per se. And they just want to take your money. So you can be holding a banana in your hand, and they will still get you for that. Outside of the city of New York, it really is up to the discretion of the police officer whether or not they want to show up in court, because most hands will fight it and try and fight it, which I did. I gave them evidence. Actually, when I got the ticket, my cell phone was mounted on the windshield, and I was using a headphone, but they saw me pick up a microphone in my hand and put it down just as I was starting to move at the traffic light. So in New York City, do not pick up a microphone. Why even stop at a stoplight? They will give you a ticket.
So as you can tell, Joe, the answer is it depends. And you got to be careful. KC2QIW, good question. K2LIW, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, roger that. A lot of times I would talk on my two-meter radio in my car and passing the police and holding up the microphone. So I guess nowadays I got to put down the microphone. By the way, how much is that summons, that ticket, the other station out there? If you don't mind me asking, how much is that ticket? So I know. Give me a heads up. Back to you.
In New York City, I guarantee it's going to be significant. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, in the city of New York, it ain't cheap. The ticket itself is $125 plus another $100 for a New York City surcharge.
So I think you're telling us it's $225 total, Eric?
Yeah. Well, I came armed with video and pictures of the car with the antennas on it and everything. What the guy did for me was nice, actually. It didn't put any points on my license.
But he still took your money. Any final questions on that, Joe?
Yeah, roger that. I'm pretty sure, I assume it's the same thing in New York over here, up in Westchester County, New York. Probably be the same price on the summons, on the ticket. So, thank you, guys. Thank you for giving me a heads up on there. So now next time when I pass all the police officers going to work on Boston Post Road over there, I think I'm gonna start putting down a microphone. Yeah, so they don't see me talking on the microphone. All right, thank you guys, and love you guys, and back to you, Dick.
Hey, Eric, yeah. Eric, if Joe was using a hands-free system, a headset, and his both hands are on the steering wheel, would he be immune from all of these problems? KE2EJ, K2IW.
If he's using a hands-free headset, he's using a headset or a Bluetooth headset, perfectly within the boundaries of the law, and if he does get a ticket, which I can't imagine he would get one, because The guy sees him with both hands on the steering wheel. There's no way in heck you can give him a ticket. And if he does, that you can fight. But you have to give some kind of visual proof. In Florida, you know, they have these, a lot of the folks, because of all the accidents they have these cameras that record the last half hour of what's going on in the car, outside of the car, behind you, and in front of you. You need some kind of proof like that. But I just can't imagine somebody using a hands-free device. The guy's probably going to think you're talking on a cell phone, it's hands-free, your hands aren't holding it, you're okay.
Maybe not true in California. When I was at Edwards Air Force Base, 1990, I had a set of earphones on my head where the earphones were...
You only allowed one ear.
I was only... The earphones were only on one ear. My right ear was covered with an earphone. My left ear was completely empty. And according to that particular policeman who pulled me over, didn't give me a ticket, but pulled me over, saying that anything that interrupts the hearing on both ears in California at Edwards Air Force Base at that time was illegal. So you even got to worry about that one, Eric. They want you to have binaural hearing in California. Over to you, Eric, for any comment.
Well, having lived in California and being there, that doesn't surprise me. Although, if you look today, because of the proliferation of cell phones and having Bluetooth devices, that law may have changed, but then again, it may have not. I only really know about New York State law, and you're allowed to have one ear as a hearing device.
Now that we have these red light cameras that are recording everything at a particular intersection, even if there's no policeman there, if as you go through that red light camera, and you're going on to that, the camera-equipped red light, traffic light, in theory, they could review that film, look at the fact that you're using a electronic device, and I guess they could potentially do something with a citation along those lines. Or am I just being paranoid on this one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, the thing that I'm aware of, red light camera is really concentrating on looking at your license plate, both the front and the back of the car. And they don't take moving images, they take still. The sense wires in the road actually know when the vehicle is in the intersection, and that triggers the computer that fires off the camera and takes a snapshot. They don't actually continuously record, because that would be an awful lot of data that they would have to store. And if you've seen some of the photographs that actually come, you sometimes just don't get clarity within the windshield. Sometimes you do. As far as whether the individual that is preparing those summonses to take that into account, I'm not really aware of. But it's the license plate that they look at. And by the way, the ticket goes to the owner of the vehicle. You could have somebody else driving it, and you're still going to get the ticket if you own the vehicle.
E2HEC with a comment.
Go ahead, Steve.
I have to disagree with Eric on this one. They very much take moving pictures. The last red light camera violation I got, they were kind enough to direct me to a website where they showed me a nice home movie of me making a right turn without coming to a complete stop. This way I had something, you know, to entertain me while I was filling out the form for my summons. KD2HUC, back to net.
You know, that's entirely possible. Last time I've seen one is a number of years ago.
Okay, I kind of thought it was a motion picture. In the case of a stop and go on a red light, I think the crazy rule is you have to stop for 4 seconds before proceeding. They can only prove that to you with a motion picture. I still wouldn't prove that to you. Okay, let's see what John's got to say. KC2SHO from Los Alamos, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
K2RIW. KC2SHO. Stand by 1 second. Okay. I had to finish chewing now. I was eating some dinner. My question this evening
I've always just accepted the fact that electrons flow in the opposite direction of current. I was hoping that you could get some words on that. Maybe it would be interesting to talk about why that is. Why does current flow in the opposite direction of the electron flow? There's got to be some interesting backstory here. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
C2IS, I can comment on that if you'd like.
Yeah, I'm going to comment first, Bill, and then I'm going to turn it over to you for correcting my errors. Back in the old days of vacuum tubes, we were pretty darn sure that the cathode was hot. It boiled off electrons. Electrons flowed from cathode to plate, and we talked about current flow as the direction that the electrons flowed in the tube days. Along comes the more modern solid-state devices of both NPN and PNP transistors, and all of a sudden somebody decided to set a standard where current is the movement of theoretically positively charged particles. So you make believe that the current flows out of the positive lead of the battery, and positively charged particles move through the wire, go through the device on the test, and then come back to the negative lead of the battery. So nowadays, current flow is the movement of positively charged particles, even though what's really moving in the wire is electrons. And they sort of get around that now by a hokey technique where they say that when an electron moves from position A to position B, it creates a hole. And so an electron moving to the right is creating a hole that's moving to the left, and the hole is the positively charged particle, so to speak. They get around it that way. Let me drop it. So the standard today is current flow is the movement of positive charge. And in almost everything that we do with conductors, simple conductors like copper, then the current is a negatively charged particle that's really doing the moving. In the case of the current that flows through a human being, it's not electrons that are flowing, it's ions. And you've got some positive flow, positive charged ions and negative charged ions that are flowing through your body when you put your hands across the two terminals. So life gets a little bit more complicated. AC2IS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, Dick, I think you covered just about everything I was going to say. I think back in the day, people were doing experiments with the cathode and anode, getting electrons basically to jump between two terminals. And it was the cathode that would get hot, because we know now electrons left the anode and then hit the cathode at high speed, heating it up. But back in the day, they thought that the cathode, since it glowed, I guess, since it got hot, was where the particles were and where they were leaving, hence, you know, cathode ray tube. Let me let it drop for a second. Then also, Dick was talking about the terminology referring to electron holes. And so if you look into explanations of how diodes and transistors work, basically they spend a lot of time talking about these electron holes, like Dick was saying, and if you just sort of filter out all the stuff where they talk about electron holes and understand that this is just due to the essentially the wrong terminology that we came up with back in the day, and sort of explaining away how current moves in one direction and the electrons move in another direction, if you then take out all that electron hole terminology, which is sort of technobabble in this context, there's typically nothing left of the explanation of how a diode or a transistor works. So those explanations, to me, always just seem like a whole bunch of hand-waving with no real information conveyed. AC2IS.
AC2GS here.
Go right ahead, Roy. Straighten us out on all this. Our science physics expert, you got it, Dr. Roy.
Well, it's my understanding that it predates all of this, the cathode tube, the semiconductor, everything. The problem is it probably goes back with that poor guy Volta who invented the battery cell. So you're stuck with